Hello there, I'm Patricia Glynn, and this is Story Catcher. Simple stories, simply told. Welcome to Potpourri, a monthly collection of short stories. They're universal, they're everyday, and they're about the kind of dramatic events, small joys, and certain sorrows that happen in all our lives. Most importantly, they're your stories, submitted by you and recorded as I travel the subcontinent in my beloved truck, Lady Alexandra. So you're in charge of where I go and when. Please get your suggestions to me as soon as you can via our submissions page so that I can collate the stories by theme and or region and then set off. Now that sound is designed to help you skip stories that aren't for you and head directly for those that might be. There's a very brief synopsis of each story on the podcast page, which will help you navigate. And of course, if you want to listen to the whole podcast, the chapters will flow automatically from one to the other. Look out for the small collection of photos of each guest, which you can take a look at before or during your listen. Now, I don't know, of course, how long it'll take for your submissions to come in, and we'll need to collate them so that I have sufficient in my basket to warrant a visit to your area. So, meantime, I've recorded some stories that I've heard about from friends or friends of friends. I was in Cape Town for 9 months last year, so our first edition of Potpourri contains stories of the deep blue sea, that great unknown that can be so kind and so cruel. There are three stories of remarkable coincidence, the reminiscences of one of Cork Bay's famous fishermen, two tales about shark encounters with very different outcomes, and the story of a cache of alcohol that lay beneath the Antarctic waters for a century before its discovery. Just a word about where and how our stories are produced. I gather them on the road in my truck and bring them back to my camp here at the foot of the Magaliesberg Mountains for editing and pulling together with the help of Amy Moss. And I do mean camp. I live under canvas, so please don't expect studio quality sound here on Storycatcher. My safari tent might billow and creak. The birds will give us their contribution, as they are this morning. And maybe jackals will join us if I'm working late. In due course, I'll get a photo or two up on the website of my gorgeous camp here in the Bushveld. We begin, though, far away in Cape Town. This is a hair-raising tale from one of the city's many surfers. And the black flag with the shark on it means?
It's shark sort of conditions, but it's not an actual shark spotted.
And you would go out with that flag up?
Yeah, it's almost always...
Of course she'd go out. Bernie Shelley is mad, like many of the surfers here in False Bay. We're meeting on Musenberg Beach because it's one of the Cape Peninsula's most famous surfing spots, and she's one of its most famous surfers. As an aside, I'll tell you who surfed at Musenberg, none other than Agatha Christie, the crime writer. She surfed there in 1922 and wrote that she found swimming very boring by comparison. Anyhow, back to Bernie Shelley. She's been South African surfing champion 3 times and Western Province champion numerous times. But what impresses me most is that she's still out there on her longboard at the age of 77. 77. You see, Bernie, you can have this. This is why I live inland. Wind. It's a horrible thing.
No, I hate.
So, beaten by the weather, we head for one of Musenberg's surfing shops. The shop was pumping, and Bernie fitted right in with her dungarees and big tinted glasses. The woman simply doesn't age. A television in the corner was showing footage of some surfers in Hawaii or wherever.
I don't use feet or meters, I use body parts.
That's what you can lose. The waves were gigantic. They seemed to suck the riders in, play and dance with them, then spit them out when they'd had enough. That surfing is a sport, and sometimes a very dangerous one, is in no doubt. But what I was seeing was a combination of such elegance and artistry. It was like a cross between gymnastics and ballet. And all at such speed, I found it difficult to tear myself away. We found a quiet corner at the back of the shop and chatted about the addiction, albeit a healthy one, that Bernice had since she was a teenager in the mid-1960s. From the get-go, she was unusual because while other girls stayed on the beach looking pretty in their, what is it, itsy-bitsy, teeny-weeny, yellow polka dot bikinis, Bernie grabbed a longboard and said, "I want some of that." It made her something of a suffragette. I'm sorry. And it made her part of a revolution of sun-drenched teenagers, living free and quite rough as they travelled from one surf spot to another in search of the perfect wave. It was a lifestyle embodied in the movie Endless Summer. Their soundtrack was Bob Dylan, Joan Baez and the Beatles, and their transport was invariably VW combis, which is slang here in South Africa for a kind of microbus. It became something of a symbol of the surfing subculture here and was often referred to as a passion wagon. You'd sometimes see a bumper sticker on its rear that said, "Don't laugh, your daughter may be in here."
Please tell me your car was a Volkswagen.
It was a Volkswagen.
No,
a Beetle.
Yes,
a Beetle. When you're short, you can. But mainly we just slept outside.
Lots of Sedgwick sherry and Doobie, or was it like that?
It wasn't so... Well, look, I'm a bit of a dumbass as far as that goes, because I don't drink and I don't smoke and so on. But it was just... That culture was just starting. It was old brown sherry. Popular thing. Yeah. And the Doobies and all were... It wasn't very open back then.
No, it was completely forbidden.
Forbidden and outlawed everywhere at the time, dope was, of course. Not that it stopped rockers like Mick Jagger. Do you recall him saying, "Those who remember the 60s weren't there"? So Bernie wasn't indulging in drugs, but she did specialise in verboten fashion at a time when the Calvinist uniform for girls in South Africa was crimpline A-line dresses and patent leather shoes.
I was sort of unusual, because back then women wore their hair all sort of washed up, teased and whatnot, and I didn't. I had hair like it was...
Oh, it's like those beehives.
Beehivey things.
Stacks of eyeliner.
Yes.
Like Priscilla Presley.
Yes, those sorts of things, which I didn't. I was plain Jane and straight hair, non-makeup, and wearing a mini skirt. People used to look at you. There goes Bernie Woods, you know. And being a girl amongst a lot of guys was also a scandal. There must be something going on there. Meanwhile, I was incredibly naive. And I remember once going to a movie in a miniskirt and wearing raffia flowers we used to make for our feet.
And they were only barefoot sandals.
And barefoot sandals, yes. And they wouldn't let me in because I wasn't appropriately dressed.
In time, Bernie the Rebel made way for Bernie the Responsible. She met the love of her life, Alan, actually on the very same day she discovered the other love of her life, surfing. And they've been married for 56 years. She gave up surfing to raise 4 children, but was instantly hooked again the first time she caught a wave 25 years later. But what hooked her? What is that feeling? I've always wanted to know.
Like nothing. You're just in a zone and you're unaware of anything around you. It's just like meditation, I suppose. I don't meditate, but there's nothing but you and that board and that wave. It's not describable. You're part of the divine in that moment. Everything else is lost. It's then. And it doesn't last for long, because you're not there for that long. That little pleasure, it's something
deeply spiritual, but not spiritual in, not in a religious way. It's a self-affirming type of way. It's getting rid of everything but yourself.
Decades of Zen-like pleasure have graced her life by now, but there was one day out there which was far from Zen.
It was a SA longboard surfing champs, and we were at Victoria Bay, which is near George. And it was semi-finals, and there were two of us sitting out there waiting for our heat to start. The previous heat was a few meters away from us. And the girl sitting with me, Lynn, said to me, "Ooh, is that a dolphin looking next to my board?" And I looked around and I went, "It's a shark." And there was this monstrous thing about the size of a shovel, you know, a builder's spade.
Yeah.
The fin was, and it was right next to me.
And you had your legs.
And my legs were dangling down there. Anyway, we sort of said, "Oh, well, we better sort of make our way out of here." And you'd think that we'd be panicky and terrified and all, but it was actually surreal. It was like being part of nature. There was almost an intimacy with the shark, and it followed me right next to me like an obedient lamb. It was right there all the way. We paddled towards the rocks to get out as quickly as possible. And it was my most close to nature encounter I've ever had. This massive thing that people are terrified of, and it obviously didn't want to hurt me, and it obviously was just curious, and there it was coming along with me, utterly surreal.
You know, we hear about splashing in the water as a trains them, and you were splashing.
We were very, very deliberate in our fingers were sort of inching ourselves over the water. There wasn't vigorous paddling at all.
Clever girl, she did exactly the right thing. And someone who knows this all too well is Craig Foster, he of My Octopus Teacher fame.
When you put your hand in the water to swim, you carefully drop it in. You don't slap it down. Animals react to things like muscle tension. So if you're going in the water every day, of course you're going to be extremely relaxed. Then you don't chase animals away. They don't, you know, they don't like splashes and movements, and they're very sensitive to pressure as well. Pressure waves. They can feel them along their lateral lines.
What Bernie experienced that day is something that marks those who embrace the wild deeply and without reserve, for however short a time.
And the feeling was, I am nature. It was that feeling. That I'm here watching nature, looking at birds through my binoculars and all that. It was, I am here, I'm part of this. Me and this shark are one. It's really difficult to explain it. This was stark nature.
You soon realize, because you think you're alone, but of course you're not in any way. That's the beauty of when you start to dip under that skin, because all your animal kin are around you, and they're the best teachers on the planet. And they've always been there from the beginning, and you've had relationships for as long as our species has been on this planet, 300,000 years for Homo sapiens, and then our whole hominid lineage goes back millions of years. So you've had millions of years of these relationships and these wild teachers.
There's a long mystical tradition of becoming one with the universe, of course. Buddhist monks induce it through meditation. They describe a feeling of all barriers between you and the cosmos having suddenly disappeared, and that feeling of oceanic oneness, of being absorbed into the stars and the sea and the sky. Such a privilege, and known to so few. Lucky Bernie Shelley and lucky Craig Foster. I have another shark story for you later on, that one definitely not lucky. Craig is featured in our Inspirations podcast this month. Inspirations features people who are asking the big questions and living the big lives. It aims to go deeper than we do here in these potpourri short stories. And by the way, Craig and I chatted about everything but octopuses. He's a fascinating man. And you can find the link to our chat in the podcast section of my website. The amazing Amy, that's my editor, Amy Moss, has just pointed out to me that I suggested you go and look at photos of Bernie Shelley, but I didn't tell you where to go. Well, they're on the website, on the podcast page, along with those of other potpourri guests. Each one has a little collection of photos, which I find quite useful because we're all curious about what people look like and what they're talking about. Here now is a tale from the distant past that has two startling coincidences. One you might know about, and one you most definitely won't. I've included this story in our collection of Cape Town Sea Stories because it involves an icebreaker called the S.A. Agulhas II that's moored in Cape Town Harbour. But there are actually two ships at the heart of this story, and what they have in common is the man who I and millions like me regard as the hero of all heroes and leader of all leaders, Ernest Shackleton. Now, people who have a passion for Shackleton and his exploits are known as Shackleheads, but you don't need to be a Shacklehead to know at least something about this great man's attempt to cross Antarctica via the South Pole in 1914. The expedition went down as one of the most grueling tests of human endurance and courage ever known. The trip spanned 18 months and two pitiless winters in Antarctica and was marred by a series of escalating tragedies that we needn't concern ourselves with here. The first of those blows was the sinking of Shackleton's ship, Endurance. She was trapped in pack ice in the Weddell Sea, crushed like an almond in a nutcracker, and sank 3,000 metres to the bottom of that freezing ocean in November 1915. To his eternal credit, the Endurance became the only casualty of Shackleton's benighted expedition. And since then, the shipwreck has taken on an almost mythical status. Her location became the obsessive pursuit of many a professional and armchair maritime sleuth. And finding her in 2022 was the honour and privilege of those on board the Agulhas II under the captaincy of Knowledge Bengu. Now, it just so happens that one of my very dearest friends, Rob Caskey, is a Shacklehead on steroids and a brilliant storyteller to boot. So he's going to tell us about the coincidence involved in finding Endurance. He starts with his belief that Shackleton had successfully hidden a major heart complaint from his sponsors and the world when he next went to Antarctica, this time aboard the Quest. You might have heard that the wreck of the Quest was discovered fairly recently off the Canadian coast. Shackleton took with him Frank Wild, who had been his second in command on the Endurance expedition, and seven other crew from that journey.
Shackleton and Wild had come up with this wonderful term, "those little white voices keep calling me back," which is all about the allure of the Antarctic. Now, we refer to this often, and having been there often, I can relate directly to the idea of "those little white voices keep calling me back." And when Shackleton put together the expedition on the Quest, which was supported by a businessman in England called Rowlett or Rowlett, Shackleton had no clear intention of what he wanted to do. They spoke about geographic exploration around the coast of Antarctica. There was nothing planned on land. But I think that Wild, I think that Macklin the surgeon, and I think that a lot of men who endured all those deprivations on board of the Endurance, who signed up to go back with Shackleton, knew that it was a last hurrah. And they knew that Shackleton was going back to the place he loved more than anywhere else on earth to finally exit this lifetime. Now, the fact that they were at anchor in Grytviken, they weren't at sea, when he wasn't feeling good, and he called his surgeon Macklin down to chat to him and examine him. And Macklin realized then that the time was very near for Shackleton to expire. in terms of this ongoing heart condition. Well, Shackleton never made the dawn. That was the 5th of January of 1922. So the body was embalmed and prepared for a journey back to England. And the men went out after the embalming process and so forth and built this incredible cairn with a big cross on it on King Edward Point at the entrance to Gritfikin Harbour on South Georgia. And Wild then took over of the quest and continued with the geographic exploration around South Georgia with a plan to go to Antarctica. And the body was accompanied by Macklin and some others on a separate ship back to Buenos Aires on its way to England. And when they got to Buenos Aires, a telegram was sent to his wife, Emily Dornan. And she said Antarctica always was his mistress, bury him there. So the ship was turned around and returned to South Georgia with the body. Shackleton's men were assembled off the quest, and the body was only buried on South Georgia a full 2 months after Shackleton died. He was buried on the 5th of March of 1922, aged 47. Now, what makes the story all the greater for me, you couldn't make this up. Our renowned icebreaker and scientific expedition ship, SA Agalas II, captained by a young Zulu captain from Umlazi, Captain Knowledge Bengal, found the Endurance in 3,008 meters of water, more than 10,000 feet, pitch dark, at the floor of the Weddell Sea, on the 5th of March 2022, centenary to the day of Shackleton's burial. And we talk about the legends growing in the telling. There are certain parts of this story where you think there's a greater force or a greater influence involved in what happened here.
Well, quite so. There's another coincidence involved here that I learned about only recently. The maritime archaeologist on board the Agalas II was a chap called Menson Bound, who has written a book about the expedition to find Endurance called The Ship Beneath the Ice. Their search for Shackleton's ship had had a nail-biting conclusion because they ran out of time to find her. They'd fine-tooth-combed about 80% of the area where they thought Endurance might lie, but desperately wanted to complete just a little bit more of the grid map before calling it a day. But the lease period on the icebreaker was at an end. Captain Bengu gave them as much of an extension as he could, 10 days. That was risky because by early March it was minus 40 degrees in the Antarctic and the winter ice was slowly closing in on them. So ironically, the Agalas II was now threatened by the very same fate as Shackleton's ship. Anyhow, one of the chaps on the team controlling the submersible craft scanning the bottom of the seabed was Fred Bassemayous. Hope I pronounced that correctly. Fred is described by Menson Bound as one of life's pilgrims, somebody with a mystic streak and the soul of a poet. Shackleton would have loved him. Fred wondered if there wasn't something even more to this whole thing. What if Shackleton was lowered into the earth at exactly the same time as the ship was discovered, 4 minutes past 4 in the afternoon? He and Bound set about trying to work out if this was possible. Now, one of the guys who accompanied Shackleton's body back to South Georgia and attended the church service and the burial had left a diary. So back in the UK, an enthusiastic Shacklehead consulted the diary and, working from information such as when the church service started, how long it took for the coffin to be carried to the graveyard, Shackleton would have been buried at or shortly after 4 p.m. As Rob said, there are certain parts of this story where you think there's a greater force or greater influence involved in what happened here. By anyone's definition, Rob is a brilliant storyteller, I'm sure you'll agree, and he lectures on cruise ships in the Antarctic and for audiences both in South Africa and abroad. Have a look at his website, engagingstorytelling.com. I'm going to try and include at least one historical story per potpourri, but I like the small stories that played out on a large landscape. You know, I'm more interested in the ordinary soldiers on the battlefield, for instance, than I am in the generals. So let me know if you have any stories from yesteryear that you think we should cover. Next, another sea story with a remarkable coincidence, but a contemporary one. This story deals with the arc of two lives that initially diverged, then came together almost inexplicably decades later. It's the summer of 1942, and we're on the beautiful beach at Wilderness along the Indian Ocean coast of South Africa. 15-year-old Heather Warren and her cousin are soaking up the sun when they spot a large black inner tube from a tractor tire floating way out beyond the breakers. Now, tractor tubes make for great fun on a river. I did it myself as a kid. You sit in them and you get towed behind a motorboat. It's rather like a slower version of water skiing. It's great fun. Both cousins are champion swimmers, so they decide to swim out and fetch the tube. Only when they get close to it, they realize it's not a tube at all. It's a woman in a black swimming costume, bobbing and rolling in the swell. She appears to be dead, her arms outstretched in the water, lifeless and weightless. And clinging to her neck is a terrified little girl. That little girl was 5-year-old Elaine Oosterbrook, and I met her when she was in her 80s, living with her little dog Molly in Johannesburg. She was petite and moved quickly. Elaine, that is, not Molly, who's a little black barrel. We drank tea, Molly snored, and Elaine told me about that unforgettable day in 1942. Like the Warren teenagers, she too had been soaking up the sun further down Wilderness Beach.
We were with the Watson family, and I had two elder cousins, and they set out to go and swim. And I ran after them, and they were unaware, and I got caught in a, suddenly there are these holes near the rocks. And I fell into the hole and got swept out by a riptide.
On the rocks was a fisherman, who watched helpless as the screaming child was dragged out into deep water.
And I never forget, he just shrugged. I mean, but what could he do?
Back on the beach, that awful, awful realization dawned on Elaine's mother, Gwen, that her daughter had disappeared.
You know how mother is? She kind of looked around and thought, where's the child? Now, she couldn't swim. But I suppose if you see your child being carried out and drowning, you will go. And so she came, and then I think I was terrified, and I think I was so frightened when she came, I clung round her neck. She was the one that was very close to dead.
The two Warren cousins tried desperately to get mother and child to shore, but even as experienced lifesavers, they found it far from easy. Gwen felt like a dead weight, and in her blind panic, little Elaine was making things very tough as well.
I vaguely remember them trying to pull me off my mother. Oh, and then I do remember I transferred my clinging onto Heather.
The little limpet.
I think I vaguely remember her saying, "Don't hold me there, I can't swim."
Well, Elaine survived her near drowning, clearly, and so did her mother, although Gwen had to be hospitalized for a few days. When she recovered, she presented each of the Warren cousins with a gold watch to thank them for their heroic efforts. On the back of each was engraved, "I owe you my life. Thank you, Gwen Oosterbrook." Now, a near-death experience sometimes prompts a profound change in direction. Perhaps it did for Gwen.
Do you remember her ever remarking on how wonderful it was to have a second lease on life? She would have been more aware of
it. Is this being recorded?
Should be, yes. I'm technically a bit stupid.
I don't want what I'm going to say.
Okay.
Can you switch?
And what do you do when a conversation becomes a bit awkward? You have another cup of tea. During the tea break, Elaine told me what she wanted to keep to herself out of respect for her mother. No problem. But when she was on mic again, quite spontaneously, she changed her mind.
All right, do it. I think
Was there anybody who would be hurt?
No, not now. This only came out literally about 5 years ago. I myself only discovered this, that she told her very, very close friend that when she thought she wasn't going to make it, she said, and you know, I realise I've messed up my life. I've married the wrong man. And then when she found she had survived and came out of hospital and we returned from holiday, I think to my poor father's unutterable shock and dismay, she said, I want to divorce and marry Fitz. You know, the man she actually had fallen in love with at university, and then they'd gone their separate ways.
And who was Fitz?
Fitz was Dr. Vivian Fitzsimons, who she did marry. A most amazing, lovely stepfather to me.
Were you aware of the quality of their relationship, your mum and Fitz?
I was aware then, and thinking back on it, I've never, ever known two people so in love and so happy together.
Gwen only lived to her mid-60s, so just as well she got on with the business of being happy for the remaining 30 years of her life. Elaine, too, was happily married for many years, and when she was eventually widowed, she moved into Silvermine Retirement Village in the Cape. She was in reception one day reading a newspaper article about her nephew, Ken Oosterbrook. Ken was a talented and well-known South African news photographer who was shot in controversial circumstances in a township just prior to our first democratic elections. Another Silvermine resident was reading the paper over Elaine's shoulder.
So I said, piping up, I said, yes, well, of course it was murder. It wasn't an accident. Wasn't a stray bullet at all. And she said, Ken Oosterbrook, I have a gold watch, and on the back it says, I owe you my life. Thank you, Gwen Oosterbrook. Would that be a relation? I said, that's my mother. And she looked at me. She said, you, the little girl I pulled out the sea.
It was Heather Warren, over 70 years since the near drowning. Now, some would regard that encounter as a miracle. Others as the result of a sequence of coincidences, maybe. The teenagers happened to be on that part of the very long wilderness beach. They happened to see and want the black in a tube, and they happened to be very strong swimmers. So they managed to get Gwen and Elaine back to shore. I asked Elaine whether she thought she'd been lucky on that day, or fated, or blessed.
You can believe in this and you can believe in that. I have to kind of believe your time of coming in maybe, but your time of going and leaving is preordained. If it's not your time to go, I don't think.
Does that give you peace? Now, I mean, you're an old lady. You're an elderly lady, sorry, not old.
I'm old. Why put a fine point on it?
Okay. You're an old lady now. Does that give you peace, knowing that when the day comes, it comes, and there's not a lot you can do about that?
It has naturally made me humble. And it's made me read more sensibly.
Yep, you know what they say about life being too short to drink bad wine and read bad books. And just to finish off our story, Elaine saw the precious gold watch once, but it eventually disappeared from Heather's cottage. Heather Warren became Heather Maltby, and she was a prolific and very good painter. She kept working till her death at the age of 89, even though her eyesight faded. Elaine's son, Simon, bought one of her paintings, and it hangs in his home in America. On the back, he's written, I owe my life to the painter of this work, as do my children and all those who come after them. Heather kept up her swimming and was utterly fearless in the water right till the end. The next three generations of her female offspring became, wouldn't you know it, lifesavers. Amazing. I have no doubt you'll send in more stories of synchronicity or coincidence or just plain luck to Storycatcher, because we love them. Well, I hope you do. I do. We're always searching for meaning and patterns in this random and ruthless universe of ours, patterns that help us see our lives as somehow significant, not as cosmic accidents. I went to see Elaine about 18 months after we'd recorded her interview to play her the finished product, which you've just heard. Not only did I want to get her consent for what we'd produced, but because there was a chance that she wouldn't be around when Storycatcher launched. Elaine had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and was living on borrowed time. Molly was gone. She died at the ripe old age of 18 or 19. We sat in Elaine's sunroom drinking tea, just like before. You remember what Elaine said about her proximity to death having the effect of making her read more sensibly. Well, now that that proximity was even closer, I was particularly interested in knowing what she was reading. Her bedside table was still full of books, light fiction to put her to sleep, she said, a book about Helen of Troy, Proof of Heaven, an account of the afterlife apparently experienced by a medical doctor in the States, and the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So a combination of sensible but inquisitive reading matter. The remarkable Elaine Hurry died on the 26th of September at the age of 87. Go well, Elaine, go well. Further south from Musenberg, where I met Bernie, is the village of Cork Bay, made famous by the fisher folk who have lived there for 200 years or more. They're among the best handline fishers in the world and trace their origins from exotic places way across the sea, the Philippines, Java, Malaya, Portugal. The mountain amphitheatre in which they live overlooks a small harbour, and not so long ago, it still resonated with calls to man the boats and head out, or triumphant whoops when the catch was brought back. Generations of my family spent holidays in an old house on the rocks, very close to the harbour. My great aunt used to tell of trains pulling out of Cork Bay Station in the early 1900s, piled high with crayfish, off to sell to the coloured communities elsewhere in the peninsula. Crayfish was not a white man's food back then. As a child, I remember the raucous banter of the fishermen's wives as they auctioned their menfolk's catch on the harbour wall. Great mounds of silver fish slipped off their tables as the women gutted and bantered and sold their gifts from the ocean. It was all so bountiful. And it's over. Reef and rock and pelagic, the fish of False Bay are all but gone, killed off by big, fast ski boats that locate the shoals quickly with their echo sounders and plunder them without regard for their sustainability. Chinese vessels prowl and haul at the mouth of the bay. They've bought licenses from corrupt officials and fishermen. And. Ultimately, though, the fish of the bay have been wiped out by our insatiable desire for prawns and fillet of cob, crayfish thermidor and hake and chips. It's all so damn depressing. But the fishing industry's problems are not our primary focus here. Besides, the situation has been well covered by journalists such as Don Pinnock and Pippa Ehrlich, who've produced fascinating and horrifying stuff about the slaughter being perpetrated off our coastline. The demise of the fish stocks has resulted in the demise of the fisher folk of Cork Bay, a community, their lifestyle, and their deep love and knowledge of the ocean. Many of their boats are still moored in the harbour. Their owners live in hope of legal licences so that they can head out again, even though their occasional haul is paltry. And besides, without a resuscitated fishing industry, there are no buyers for the clunky, colourful vessels that nudge each other along. I head down to the harbour with Tony Trimmel as my guide. He's a descendant of Portuguese and Filipino fishers who crossed the ocean to settle in Cork Bay in 1840. For decades, he's supplied fuel for the boats, as did his father before him, so he knows every fishy nook and salty cranny of this place.
Morning, sir. How are you? This is our famous harbour master, Mr. Shafiq Ibrahim.
Well, I'm not famous, but I am the harbour master. Thank you.
How's it?
Patricia Glynn.
So you've got nothing to do. How do you pass your day?
Patricia, that. Now I'm in trouble, eh? Now I'm in trouble.
I'm going to give you my ID now.
No, I've got eyes.
This is the famous harbour assistant. He's second in command to the harbour master.
Another one, pitch up to work, but you got no work.
Good morning, ma'am. Good morning,
ma'am. Fine, thank
you. You get a lot of lines, this guy, but what's out for you?
Two grossly fat seals are blobbed out at the start of the pier. They turn tricks for tourists, motivated by fish tossed to them all day long and can hardly move as a result.
Yeah, but it's so sad to see these boats lying idled in the harbour.
The pier is quiet, apart from the odd squeak of the tyres separating one vessel from another as they move with the lilt of the water. There's no hustle as decks are washed and lines are checked in readiness for the next outing. The only sounds I recognise from my childhood are the traffic on Main Road and the odd train.
It's two daughters.
Tony introduces me to the boats that once were the livelihood of his community.
And an Ivy Doreen.
Ivy Doreen, very famous in Cook Bay.
Like sea craft everywhere, they're named after beloveds, wives and daughters, maidens and mermaids.
That looks very romantically named, KB34A.
Well, not all of them. A woman hurries past. There's a whale at the lighthouse, she says. We hurry after her. No whale. But the lee of the lighthouse provides at least some protection from the wind. Tony looks out at the coastline and starts to describe a time when everything was different, even the sea.
What do you notice? Just look along the coast here. What do you notice?
Seaweed.
Yes. Now, seaweed in the 60s, 50s, 60s, it wasn't seaweed here.
Really?
It wasn't seaweed. You see all over. And what does that tell you? It tells you that the temperature of the water become colder in the bay over the years.
Ocean scientists concur with that. There is evidence showing that from the Cape Peninsula to Cape Agulhas, the water temperature has been decreasing since 1981. Historically, the kelp to which Tony refers was restricted to the colder west coast, around the corner from Cork Bay, so to speak. You'd find it off beaches like Camps Bay and Clifton. And in the days when False Bay was warmer, it was a completely different colour. The fisher folk called it the Blue Dam.
Why it's called the Blue Dam is because False Bay was renowned for bluish Mediterranean water. What did it attract? It attracted most of the fish species, migratory fish species, on a regular basis. And even those big bluefin tuna, the massive bluefin tuna, you know where that water's sitting now, that blue Mediterranean? Mm. It's sitting 40 miles or more outside of Cape Point. That water doesn't come into the bay anymore.
Why?
Climate change, current changes, and so on and so forth.
Why?
And that has also made that the migratory fish has been the demise of the fishing industry. I don't know if you heard about tuna catches here in Simonstown. They had these fancy charter boats. They started harvesting or catching 500 pounds, 900 pounds, but they weren't doing anything with the bluefin that they were catching. It was just for record's sake.
What, and thrown back?
It wasn't consumed in those days like today, where you catch a bluefin for that size can fetch way over a million or so, with the sushi and so on and so forth. And one of the stories, he's actually got a YouTube out now, Brian Cohen is his name, about the bluefin that came into Fishhook Bay there. They caught this bluefin and they found this hook. There was a number on the hook. And it was found that that hook that was in that bluefin tuna was caught or got away in Massachusetts, in America. So you can see how these massive, the migratory roots of these fish took effect in those days.
Who knew? I lived in Fishhook for quite a while, and the beach was a real mom and pop affair, you know. Dogs, kids, gritty sandwiches under an umbrella. It still is. Who knew that only 100 metres out there were these massive bluefin tuna? The Cork Bay fishers have relied on some migratory species of fish for their income, year in, year out, decade in and decade out. Nowadays, the catch isn't as predictable or reliable as before, and it takes long experience to capitalise on it.
You talk about the migration of fish, especially commercial fishermen depend on snook. It's a delicacy in Cape Town. It was caught by the hundreds of thousands and offloaded here in Cork Bay. The snook finds its way from Angola, coming into a specific area at a specific time. In fact, the Cork Bay fishermen believe that on May the 15th, most of them should be in Hart Bay, on the other side of the bay, because that will be the start of the snook season. The 14th, the 12th, 11th, there wasn't a sign of any snook. But they get there on May the 15th, poof, throw in the line there, the snook is
Go
waiting for them.
On. Yeah. Go on.
That actually, that is legend, one of the legends here.
It's fabulous. Tell me some more legends.
We had the shark industry here. But now you're going into the 1900s. The war comes about. They were harvesting the shark for the liver. Very rich source in oil. So he puts it in a bottle and he leaves it out in the sun. And you see that bottle just fill up with that pure oil. And it said that in the Second World War, they were actually giving these fighter pilots the shark oil to improve their eyesight. So the legend goes.
What about whaling stories?
The whaling story, if you were a fishing family, everything that was alive was consumed by fishing families. Whether it was birds, the best birds, petrels, albatross, or porpoises. Whales, yeah, these big whales used to come into the bay, and the open dinghies would, the crew would get together and they would go out and they would harpoon it, and there was that big struggle between the whale and the guys on the boat, in a very dangerous situation. You could either be pulled out of the bay or till the whale just gave up and died. But then again, you know, we progressed and conserve, and the whales are now a protected species.
But they were used by the community principally for food. It's not
The whales are brought and onto the rocks here inside the harbour. All the fat would be sort of boiled and extracted. Then the meat would be disposed of by shearing community. I mean, the whale is not just the sheep that you can just cut up and four people consume.
Enormous.
It's a lot of meat.
It's a source of celebration, but also of a lot of work.
Yeah.
So, are there any to this day taboos? You mentioned eating albatrosses or birds. Would you not eat an albatross?
If you speak about, for example, the old fishermen's wives, they were the best preparers of either the birds or the dolphins or whatever. You've got these little black petrels. It's fantastic meat. They'll be in the hundreds surrounding the boats when the guys are fishing on the day. And they'll just attack the bait, and the fishermen would catch a couple. They were so fantastic and humane in killing these birds, within a couple of seconds catching the bird, taking it between their legs and putting him to sleep. 1, 2, 3. The whole
pushing him to sleep. Thank you for your for your efforts to preserve.
One, two, three.
You say they're good eating, but there can't be much flesh on a petrel.
Oh, I'm telling you, just delicious. So, but
you know, your face changes completely, yeah, when you're talking about meals from the sea. I wish I had a camera.
Even the we call them the malmok, the wandering albatross. I mean, you're a bit wiser now. You know they mate for a lifetime. They're very, very popular. If you can catch one of them and have it for your Sunday roast, oh, it's just, if you're from a fishing community, you don't kill just for the sake of killing. You harvest to consume. The same with fishing. You don't concentrate on the reef fish day in, day out, because it's not that economical to fish on these fishing banks to harvest the red roman or whatever. Because once that snook arrives or the yellowtail, you stop fishing on that on the reefs. So the reefs has always got time to regenerate. This is what fishing is all about.
Well, fishing of old, certainly. The sea provided and the community harvested. But what's often forgotten is that lives were sacrificed in pursuit of that harvest. Some Cork Bay families lost as many as 4 of their members during storms at sea, in part because many fishermen didn't know how to swim.
Fishermen, especially skippers, went out to sea with either crew or combination of crew and day trippers. In those days, I'm talking about the 40s, the 50s, the vessels here in Cork Bay only became motorized around about the middle 30s. Before that, it was oar and sail. In other words, it was open boats. They would launch from the beach. They would sail to various spots here in the bay to do their fishing. But as the boats became motorized, they could go further afield or out of the bounds of the harbor, the safety of the harbor. And said that because of the stubbornness of some of the skippers at the time, some of them weren't talking to each other, some of them were just couldn't just stand the company of each other. They would go out and they would get into trouble out at sea. Communication wasn't so good in the 40s or so, 50s, and these guys would get into trouble, right? And instead of sending us signals for assistance,
that would just be a flash, would a flare.
Yeah.
Because they, what else did they have?
The radios only came in way into the 60s.
Yeah.
They would be out there, caught up in the change of weather. And instead of just asking for assistance, nearby assistance or other boats that were there, they would try to make it on their own getting back. In some instances, the boat would be capsized or they tried to find their way out of Falls Bay and running into Amanas or Royals or Betty's Bay and so on, and they just couldn't make it. Tragedy struck and some of the boats with crew was never found, you know. And then on another occasion, I can recall from my own family, my father's brother, out at sea. He was shot in 1950.
Shot?
Shot at sea.
At sea?
Yeah.
What happened?
The boats are lying in an area at Cape Point, in close proximity to each other. And there was a lot of rivalry also in those days with who's the best skipper and things to that effect, you know. Because if you were a good skipper, you always found or attracted the best crew. And the story goes that there's one particular skipper shot at the seal.
Why would one do that?
The seals can, even today, if you're on a shoulder snook or whatever, they can mess up your whole day.
And your destroy your lines or
destroy the lines, take your fish, chase the shoals of fish away that's under the boat.
Okay.
So these seals are there, and he takes his .22 rifle and he pops it at the seal, boom, and it the bullet ricocheted and stuck him in the chest, and he died soon after that.
Fishing is an activity that dates back at least 40,000 years in human history to Paleolithic times and carries with it a wealth of law and guidelines about how to manage the resources on which it depends. These change little from generation to generation. They're built into legends and stories and are as simple as they are profound. Fisherfolk who venture onto the oceans know how capricious and vicious the sea can be, and many superstitions reflect attempts to placate that moodiness. One of the oldest acts is to throw a coin into the water before even leaving the harbour, to show respect for the gods of the sea. Another less romantic one suggests that the skipper of the fishing boat should be discouraged from spitting overboard. That is traditionally thought to scare away the fish for kilometres around.
If you say that the sea is your mother, right? What's your relationship with the mother? It's respect, nurturing, growing up, protection. Whatever, how you treat your mother, how your mother treats you, is that the respect built up over the years. And if you carry that respect over to the sea, then the sea would respect you, it would give you, nurture you, and sustain you. One thing I can say, why the fish are so scarce? You know why? Because we ate up all the fish.
Tony Trimmel, one of the last custodians of the Cork Bay fishermen's history, knowledge and seacraft. This is the story of the warm and wise Isabel Webb and her extraordinary mother, Tana. It's a story about how the sea gives, but it also takes away.
We have checked this before, but you definitely are quite comfortable to talk about what happened.
Yes.
Why? I mean, not a lot of people would have that strength.
I think because she died in such a beautiful way.
Isabel Webb has had 20 years and a lot of self-work to become comfortable with talking about her mum's violent end and to regard it as beautiful even, as you just heard. But you haven't. So this is a warning that if you're easily horrified and or traumatized, go straight to our next story. It's the early morning of November the 15th, 2004, and 77-year-old Tana Webb is where she's been invariably for the previous 20 years. Jagger Walk on the edge of the warm sea off Fishhook in Cape Town. Dressed, as always, in a long white gown, the tall and elegant woman is a familiar sight not only to her fellow bathers but to those enjoying their morning cuppas in the houses overlooking the bay. Tana strips down to her black cozzy, puts on her red bathing cap, enters the water, and begins a ritual which, for her, is so much more than just a morning swim.
I think it was her fix. She would connect with God in the water. She felt I had a spiritual kind of connection, looking up, especially swimming backstroke. She would gaze up at the heavens and feel this connection. Besides a physical high. So it gave her a complete, it was a fix every morning. She had to have it.
Tana was about 150 metres offshore when the shouting started. A monstrously big shark was heading for her. The shark had been spotted by a lookout high on the mountain, whose job it was to watch for shoals of fish and alert the trek fishermen waiting with their nets on the beach below. He waved his signal flag, screamed like never before, and people on the walkway and in their homes soon joined in.
She was swimming backstroke, as she would every morning, and she was unaware of the shark. The shark came from the side and just took her. And I think she just lost consciousness immediately, and they said it was 30 seconds. Some of the witnesses said it was unbelievably fast. And she was a very strong, independent woman and would have struggled tremendously with being dependent on others or bedridden or losing her faculties. And she was sharp-witted when she went. She was still very clear and she went fast. So I think she went in the prime of her old age. She was 77 in prime health.
Did you resist finding out the circumstances of her death? What actually happened?
It wasn't really important. The gory details didn't really interest me. It was sensationalized. And there were many versions. She was tossed in the air. She was taken three times. And she went in 30 seconds. And I know those things. I didn't immediately want to know. But they kind of came to us involuntarily. I know that she didn't suffer. It was a very quick death and a perfect death for her.
Nonetheless, the media and the know-it-alls descended on the incident in a feeding frenzy of self-righteous, petty criticism of Tana's morning ritual. They described it as irresponsible, even reckless.
But she would always go with respect. She always said she's going into their terrain. She was the intruder, not the other way around. So she went with the greatest respect always. She wasn't irresponsible or stupid. She was very conscious of what she was doing. But her death was incredibly rare.
It was one of only five deaths from shark attack in South Africa in as many years.
And unfortunately, I think it did not help the reputation of sharks.
Exactly.
I think it put it back for a whole many years.
Which is such a complete ridiculous thing that we are the sharks' predators. We're the greatest predators. How many millions of sharks are killed for their fins, for shark fin soup? How many are taken? How many humans are taken by sharks per year? I think it's you know, it's minuscule. I don't know the figures, but the extreme opposite is, in fact, true. We are the ones wiping them out.
The fact that her death was so violent, did that in any way put your grieving back? Did it your healing back?
I don't think, you know, we found it violent. I think it was her, the best death for my mother. So in a way, we were traumatized. She wasn't traumatized. I think it was so quick and so beautiful. You talk about the full cycle of life. She's prepared herself for death long before it happened, 10 years or so, of intensive reading of all these mystics like Thomas Merton and Hildegard von Bingen and Thomas More. And, well, yeah, I can't even remember all the names.
John Donne, I think.
John Donne. She did her master's in John Donne, the metaphysics. So she came full circle. She's born of the sea. We come from the sea. And she went back to the sea. So I just think, what an incredible completion of a cycle.
All that remained of Tana Webb was her red bathing cap, and it became an infamous memento of the tragedy that unfolded in Fishhook on that day in 2004. Ask any Cape Townian if they remember the story of the lady in the red bathing cap, and they'll immediately say, "Ah, yes, the woman who was taken by the shark." As for the woman, as so often happens in reportage about gruesome incidents, Tana was largely reduced to little more than a cardboard cutout.
The danger is that because she died in such a dramatic way, people remember her for her death and not her life.
Yes. I love that question. Thank you. It's very important for people to remember her for who she was as a person. And she was extraordinarily brave. She went into Soweto during the riots in the 70s. When it was risky to do, to teach teachers. She trained teachers, and it was a calling. It was a very strong calling for her. And she could not tolerate racism. She did not. She was a very Christian, very spiritual, but she was a Christian. And she wouldn't tolerate anything that went against her belief of what was right and wrong. So she gave me so much courage. She was very courageous. Also swimming. She wasn't stupid, ever. She was close to shore. And people have, from the top of the mountain, they once saw my mum swim over a whale, being completely oblivious of it. And she was a real intellectual, academic. She studied, and she had 5 children. And she raised us all, incredible mother, always there for us, always loving, taught me a hell of a lot about life. Well-read, she loved reading. I mean, our home had the entire one wall of our dining lounge area was just books, ceiling to floor.
Clearly, Tana Webb was one hell of a woman. And I'll tell you what, her daughter is a hell of a woman too. You see, there was much more tragedy that awaited Isabel after her mother's death.
We lost two children. The last one was our son, who was taken by Table Mountain. So my mother was taken by the sea. Completely, body gone. Our son, 25 years old, went hiking on Table Mountain and disappeared.
You had no body in
no
both
body
cases?
Again, in both cases. He was exceptionally tall. He was 7 foot tall and slender and very strong, a very strong, experienced hiker. And this is 2015. So it's 8, 9 years, almost 9 years later. Still no trace of him. And that mountain was searched, fine-combed, so mysteriously taken by the mountain.
Isabel doesn't indulge in why me's, which is just as well because can you credit it? Before Philip's disappearance on Table Mountain, she and her husband lost another son, a little boy called Nicholas, who was born with a very rare heart disease and died after open-heart surgery at 6 weeks old. And yet... When you meet Isabel, you wouldn't pick up a shred of this trauma. Just the opposite.
The strangest thing is I'm quite a joyful person.
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel if people knew that I'd lost two children and my mom was killed by a shark and I had a miscarriage and my dad died very suddenly of pneumonia, how can you be joyful? You must be faking it. And quite the contrary, I went into the pain, into the the depth of pain. I sat in the depth of a deep, empty well. Dark, cold, alone. And I faced it, and I felt it, and I was devastatingly sad. And overwhelmed, and all those feelings, I let them surface so I could look at them and work with them. And that's freeing, it's liberated me to live more life more fully for those who've passed. I even sometimes breathe for my son.
She could be quoting David White, and I know she loves his poetry as I do. This is his The Well of Grief. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning down through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink, the secret water cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. After hearing Isabel's story, you'll not be surprised to learn that she now volunteers for the local hospice, where she helps people to die and their nearest and dearest to grieve. I first met Isabel when she visited my terminally ill mother, who lay dying just up the hill from where Isabel's mother died in Fishhooks Bay. Isabel is now a death doula, or soul carer, as she prefers to be known. It's a calling, and it's one which her mother Taina also fulfilled.
She loved the hospice volunteer work, as I do, because of the all the nonsense falls away and you get to the essence of the person. And it shines. But people shine when they're about to die. Most people. If they're conscious, I think consciousness is so important, if possible, to die consciously.
If they have resolved all the nonsense.
Exactly.
And so most people, you say, do.
Yes, I think if you have a chance to. I think it's, we don't know how we're going to die, so it might be very sudden in a car crash or a shark attack. And so one needs to be prepared, do the work now.
That's useful.
I think
do the work
now. Do the work now, yeah.
Expect
don't wait.
It today.
Exactly. Live with a sword above your neck.
And there's no other way of ending that conversation, I think. I called her warm and wise at the start of our chat, and I'm sure you'll agree that Isabel Webb is all of that and more.
Live with the sword above your neck. Such good advice, isn't it? And we need reminders of the importance, the imperative of living mindfully, which is the current jargon. But we all forget, don't we? I've got a card in the box next to my bed that I can't miss because the box contains my tissues and my pilikis and so forth. And on the card is written, tomorrow is promised to no one. I find that useful. Right, we talked earlier about a couple of coincidences surrounding Ernest Shackleton and his benighted endurance expedition. Well, Rob Caskey is back now with the story of a third, rather unusual occurrence to do with the great man. There are more. In fact, Shackleton has more than his fair share of the mysteries and inexplicable events that his Irish countrymen are renowned for. And luck, of course. He had lots of luck. We go back now to the time before the Endurance Expedition and an earlier attempt to be the first man to reach the South Pole. This is the Nimrod Expedition of 1907. And to bolster his men's spirits on that trip, he took along some of the Scottish Highlands' best.
So the whisky they took to Antarctica in 1907 on board of the Nimrod was blended in 1897 at Glenmore. Taken to Antarctica, 10 years old, 25 cases of 12 bottles a case, 300 bottles of whisky. We never know who hid a case of that whisky underneath the floorboards of the hut. 100 years later, in 2007, the Antarctic Heritage Trust from New Zealand lift the floorboards to do work on the floor and see in the clear ice beneath the floorboards a case of whisky. Put there 100 years earlier to the year. The New Zealanders don't want anything to be removed from Antarctica on the side that they preside over, the Ross Sea side. So the case was not complete. There were only 10 bottles in the case, not 12. Of those 10 bottles, they allowed 9 to be brought into Christchurch. in a hermetically controlled environment, minus 20 degrees, in a HEP cooler, and they're put in a cold room in Christchurch called the coolest chill in the world, with windows so film teams could come and film the whiskey. They brought from minus 20 to room temperature over 4 weeks. The New Zealanders, you've got no idea how serious they are. Anyway, McKinley's has been sold to a company called White & Mackay, which is owned by a billionaire Indian called Vijay Mallya, and he employs a man called Richard Patterson. Richard Patterson is regarded as the finest, most famous whiskey blender and taste in the world. Now, he's got a protuberance for a nose. You cannot believe it's ideal for sniffing and blending whiskey. It's insured at Lloyd's of London for $2.6 million.
No, go on.
And he is a snappy dresser like Vijay Mallya. He dresses beautifully. He likes drama, does Richard Patterson. He flies in the private jet from Scotland to Christchurch to collect some of the whiskey. Now, that whiskey has been stored in sub-zero temperatures. It's never frozen on account of being alcohol. It's golden. It looks magnificent. And he, to add to the drama, puts the three bottles that they're allowed out of the nine that have been brought to Christchurch to go back to the spiritual home of Old Highland Malt, Glenmore in Scotland. He puts them in a cooler. He has the cooler handcuffed to his wrist.
This is impossible. You lie like a cheap.
I'll tell you what. Wait. Give me 30 seconds and I'll be back because you've got to record this. Give me 30 seconds. I'll be back.
Put on the kettle while you're there, will you?
So I need to pick up the story. I've got to tell you that Richard Patterson flies with this alcohol back to Glenmore in Scotland, and of course he plays to the cameras and all that, and they've got TV cameras there. Patterson sticks a hypodermic needle through the cork into this beautiful golden fluid from the north, and he extracts some and he puts it into a glass which he looks at appreciatively. And then he inserts that $2.6 million nose and takes a number of breaths. And he takes a few sips and then he starts for the cameras. And he comes up with this whiskey tasting, which I've got to share with you. He says the malt is soft, elegant and refined. It has delicate aromas of crushed apple, pear and fresh pineapple. The spirit is exciting and vibrant with attractive tones of oak shavings, which release hints of buttery vanilla, creamy caramel, and nutmeg. A hint of Muscovado sugar completes the spectrum. The generous strength of 47.3% alcohol by volume gives the spirit plenty of impact on the palate, both harmonious and exhilarating. The whispers of gentle bonfire smoke give way to spicy rich toffee, treacle, and pecan nuts. These enticing flavors linger lovingly on the palate, but are combined by a sensual, complex array of creme brulee, orange rind, and freshly baked bread. Overall, it's a remarkable tapestry of tantalizing taste, which truly reward the palate.
Have you ever? What's next? Reminiscent of freshly cut God knows. Storyteller extraordinaire Rob Caskey, who will come and tell his tales to your audience, should you invite him to do so. Look him up on his website, engagingstorytelling.com. Tell him I referred you. Thank you for listening to our first Potpourri, a collection of short stories from Southern Africa. And thank you to my audio editor, Amy Moss, and script editor, David Lamkin. There were also other people who helped me get back on the bike after a long absence from the microphone. Danny Boyson, Brett Beverly, and Jane Morgan. More stories out on the third Wednesday of next month, and they'll be about the cradle of mankind, where I live. So, some stories of a paleoanthropological nature, as you'd expect, and others which are intriguing and heart-wrenching. See you then.